Hi everyone, and thanks for listening to Lit Radio podcast. I'm your host, Teja. Today we are joined by Sam Sahni, author of Destination 2.0, the playbook every executive needs to master hybrid work. Sam is a global workplace strategist and a technology entrepreneur with more than 20 years of experience advising boards, mentoring leaders, and delivering workplace transformations across 16 countries. A recognized thought leader in the world of work and artificial intelligence, he has spoken on global stages helping leaders reimagine the role of their offices. Destination 2.0 is the practical guide every executive needs to navigate hybrid working. Sam presents a clear, human-centered framework built around 11 pillars to transform workplaces from underused assets into thriving destinations. Hi, Sam. It's a great pleasure to have you with us on Lit Radio podcast. How are you today?
I'm very well. How are you, Teja?
I'm doing well, thank you. And it's great to have you with us. So my first question to you, Sam, is why you decided to write your book, Destination 2.0?
Yeah, it's been a very interesting story as to why I began. Over the last few years, I came across a number of workplace briefs, design documents, which were defining the direction of future workplaces for many companies. And when I reviewed them and I looked at the underlying reasoning, the underlying data, I realized that there were a lot of gaps and a lot of thinking was missed out. And when I worked across those briefs with those end users, what I discovered was that because of speed requirement, because of time scales, because of multiple considerations, often things were being missed out. And that made me think that why is that happening? How can we overcome this issue? How can we fill blind spots? And how can we provide a mechanism to companies thinking about the future of their offices? And we realized that there was no framework in place that one could deploy, one could use to ensure that they're covering all factors that should be considered in the mix of a workplace, an office project. And that gave rise to thinking that something needs to be done about it. So we initiated a research where we understood multiple factors. We looked at a lot of data, especially in the post-COVID hybrid world. And that gave rise to the Destination 2.0 framework. And that's what the book is all about, which is why we have gone all the way through making it as practical as possible for our readers.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we talk more about the framework and the book itself, could you share with our listeners, and because this is a book podcast, what was it like to write the book? What was the process like?
Yeah, it was a very interesting process. 20 plus years working in the industry, delivering office environments for end user organizations. I had the privilege of engaging with a lot of people. These are office workers, the end users. And I got to hear their concerns, their feedback, the opportunities they saw, their own life stories. And that human element is something that has always been kind of driving me in terms of how that comes into play in the process, which could be quite a serious process when an office project is being considered, whether a company is relocating into a new office or whether it's making adjustments to its existing offices. And I wanted to bring those into play, some real user stories, some real archetypes, real humans, and how do they experience the environments. So when I thought about writing, I wanted to make it as human as possible, yet as practical as possible at the same time. So within this book, what we've tried to achieve is the right mix of both of those things, of how professionals who are working hard on delivering office environments are considering their processes, are considering how their teams are structured to ensure that they can deliver best-in-class environments for the people, and at the same time, experiences of those people. And achieving that fine balance took a while. And the book is structured in a way where we clearly define the problems as they stand today. Then in the second part, we jump into multiple facets, multiple framework elements, and describe what they are, how they could be dealt with. And part three of the book is about what to do next, where you could go for further resources. And that process itself has been taxing, but I'm glad we've come to a level where it is now published as a piece of work and should be able to help many people out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I completely agree that it's very practical the way that it's been written. And now talking about the book itself. So you claim that the offices of today are not built for the needs of the hybrid world. So could you explain to us what are the issues, the main issues that the offices today have? And do we actually need offices in the hybrid world?
I'm a big believer of people working together because when we co-locate and when we have the right environments, some magic happens where collaboration kicks in. And I think humans are driven by the element of collaboration, element of sharing experience. And that's not just with the offices, that's with everything we do across our life. So I don't think offices are going away. But I think they are going to be heavily evolving. The pandemic, the COVID experience wasn't great for the world. But when people started getting back, we started understanding a new word which came into play called hybrid working. Nobody had really heard of that phrase before. And it's been 6 years since COVID hit. So we've had about 4 to 5 years of hybrid working. But when you really think about how it's being applied, many companies are still discovering what is the right formula. Now, some companies have taken a stance and are asking people to come back full time. That may be right for them. There are many companies still operating a version of hybrid, whether it's 3 days in the office, 2 days at home, or 4 days in the office, 1 day at home. There are multiple variations of it. And there are very few companies across the globe who are operating a flexible first, remote heavy type of setup. But when you look at the majority that are sitting in the middle, who are operating a version of hybrid, they've had no resources to be able to identify what are the right facets to consider. How do you make it successful? And that making it successful requires a completely different set of considerations compared to the 10, 15, 20-year-old model of everybody has to be in the office Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, everybody gets a desk. Because the way we would collaborate with people who are physically present there or not, the way we synchronize ourselves is very different in terms of the previous model. And what we are realizing right now is that hybrid work isn't the problem. It's just exposing the cracks that were existing long time ago, which we never fixed. And we are now seeing more and more of those appear. So what many companies are doing is trying to reverse the clock back to go back to the old model, whereas their people have tasted what flexibility is like, what working from anywhere could be like. And some of the intelligent companies at the same time are also realizing that it's a huge opportunity for them to access talent, irrespective of geography. But still, the click hasn't really happened. And that's what Destination 2.0 tries to fill in as a practical guide for anybody to read and really make their hybrid work successful.
Yeah, and let's talk about that click we need. And obviously, the framework in the book, which has 11 different pillars. So, unfortunately, today we won't have time to cover all of those, but I would like to go over at least some of them, starting with demographics and differences. So, how can we build a workplace that reflects the whole workforce?
Yeah, my first point on that would be that over the last few decades, we have been designing for what I call the average employee. How do I describe them? Perhaps there is a stereotypical employee in mind. They get really active at 8:30 in the morning, and they shut off at 5:30. They have no considerations of caregiving, no neurodiversity considerations, perhaps. So we've been designing for that average employee. And the truth is that average employees don't exist. I call them the ghost employees. They're never there because they're never in real life. And 20 years of engaging with people working across offices, when you present the persona, the profile of an average employee, nobody really recognizes them in that bucket itself. They say, maybe some of the traits match what I do, but I'm different. And everybody says that. So that's where the chapter where I've written heavily about demographics and their differences comes into play. And it talks about the variations in terms of what people's characteristics are, how they operate in their roles, in their life. How do those differ from each other? And I talk about how do you recognize those elements? And that's the starting point of part two of the book, which is the first pillar, to really understand demographics and their differences. And as the book goes from there on, it starts to tell you what can you do about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what you said earlier about now that we work in a hybrid world, and obviously employers, they have the access to talent from all over the world. It's even more important to be able to make everyone work together well. So yeah, I think that first pillar of the framework is very important. But now I will move to another one, which is experience and personalization. So, how do we design for individuals and not for roles, which is what we used to do in the past?
Yeah, this absolutely builds on from your previous question, Taya, on demographics and their differences. Experience and personalization starts to go more into what do you do once you've recognized those differences between the demographics. And I think many companies are still operating offices out there which are just desks and meeting rooms with the view that you work at a desk and you collaborate in a meeting room. The first step we've seen over the last decade or so is a variety of different spaces that are being offered to the users of that office space. So you could go into a phone booth if you have a phone call, which has been very popular, especially in the hybrid environment, because people are connecting through video calls on a daily basis across the world. There would be focus spaces, whether they're individual or they're libraries. There would be different types of collaboration spaces. So the variety of space has started to kick in, which is definitely a first step towards sort of self-driven experience. So I can pick the right space to choose the task at hand. But here in the book, what we are really trying to do is how do you start to offer more attributes to each of those spaces? So people can self regulate those environments, be it from lighting, from acoustics, from multiple attributable purposes, so the space can be personalized to the next level. Many people have this thinking that how much personalization is good from a cost perspective? How far do you go? What we argue here is you don't really have to design for each individual. But what you should consider is how do you add those attributes which give people a degree of choice to be able to regulate their environments so that they find them best for the task at hand. For example, the way you may want to focus would be quite different to the way I may want to focus. And if I have that choice within a destination, then my flow of work could be much smoother. And same for you as well. So we have provided very practical methods, which we're calling builder boxes. In chapters like these, that really help readers of the book to start applying those from maybe the next Monday onwards.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking about the different kind of people in the workplace, people, they have different lifestyles, they have different needs to be able to focus or to collaborate with individuals. And especially now we're at a very interesting place in the workplace because we have people from 20 to 65, 70 years old working together. So that's a lot of different generations working in one space. And obviously, we need a workplace to be built for everyone. So, how do we do that, especially when we have so many different generations working together?
Yeah, generations is an interesting topic. I have never been personally in favor of bucketing people and stereotyping them based on the year of their birth. I have always come across people who say, yeah, I might have been born in that particular generation, but my preferences are different. I have seen baby boomers who are really advanced in technology, and I have seen millennials who really want to go into the office a lot more. So I have always kind of come across patterns of behavior that really challenge the stereotypical narrative. And I think it builds upon from the demographics and their differences chapter that you've really got to start recognizing what traits your team presents and how do you build equity within that layer of diversity. So what we are advising in the book is how do you begin to recognize that? And how do you begin to layer some of the life stages as well? So there may be a person who is maybe a Gen Y, who is a young parent, which is happening a lot in the current cultural dynamics we're experiencing. How does that influence their working patterns? There may be a millennial or even a younger generation person who may be neurodiverse. And that really changes their behavior in terms of what they're doing, how they're expecting things, how they absorb information, and how they contribute in a team dynamic. Those all elements need to be really understood. And again, we are providing very practical methods of how a team begins to build that understanding and finds those common moments where collaboration really happens across multiple facets within that demographics, be it generation or be it many other factors.
Yeah, so it's not so much about what generations we've got working together, but their individual needs as people and humans.
Absolutely. And that would vary by sector, that would vary by geography. I think the risk we are seeing right now is when you start bucketing people and you start making decisions, those decisions aren't valid when you cross borders. For example, the way a particular age group might work in a particular geography, for example, say in Middle East or Far East, for example, would be very different to how they might operate in Europe or the US. So even that particular layer of differentiation makes a huge difference, which is just an example that you should never try and stereotype people and assume that, I don't know, millions of people are working in a particular manner or their expectations are all the same.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially as someone who is living as a foreigner in the UK, yeah, I can absolutely see that. Oh, for some people here in the UK, some things are pretty normal, but where I come from, that's not the usual culture. So yeah, I absolutely agree with you on that. And then I'll move to another pillar in the book, and which is part of the Destination 2.0 framework, which is technology as a driver. So we know that technology, it has been part of the corporate world for a very, very long time, but since the COVID pandemic, obviously it became even more important. So what role does it play in the workplace of the hybrid world?
Yeah, technology is a very, very important kind of spine that basically runs through everything. Like you and I wouldn't be connecting right now if it wasn't for the technology element. So absolutely nobody could argue with that aspect. But when it comes to hybrid working, technology considerations have a critical role to play in defining whether your future collaboration, I would even take it far as concentration and contemplation patterns really kind of meet what you had been designing for. The simplest example is a hybrid meeting setup. So when you go into a room, how is technology enabling those remote voices to be able to contribute as much as the voices in the room? And that's where design of technology starts to come into play, so that everybody can have equity in the room. By the way, there's another chapter in the book where we take it even further in terms of the connectivity and the cultural layers that come into play with regards to making this happen. But going back to technology, I think we are seeing those considerations play out a lot more in terms of not just the physical design of the environment itself, but the technology overlay. There are a few other considerations around technology as well that we are seeing. Since hybrid work has kicked in, we've seen a huge rise in desk booking platforms available, for example. Now, that's all great because it helps you reserve a space that you're going in for, gives you a degree of certainty. But the interesting thing is, what we are seeing is the behavioral implications of that prior to somebody going in into an office. So if I open the app and I start to see that most of the desks are reserved, it discourages me already before I even go in, because I already have the perception that I'm going to struggle to find the space today. Especially, I'm going to struggle finding a space next to somebody who I really want to work with. So all of these considerations are important because they drive a degree of behavioral dynamics within a company, from collaboration to presence to even sort of feeling involved. And we cover these in a lot more detail in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And just one follow-up question, Sam, because I'm thinking of what we've discussed about demographics, how we can have people from different locations working together. And when it comes to meetings, so you mentioned hybrid meetings. So how can we make sure that people who are in the room together and those joining online can they can all feel like they collaborate equally?
Yeah, I think there are a number of behavioral as much as cultural elements that play out here. We are seeing smart leaders who are enabling hybrid collaboration at another level behave very differently. They ensure that those remote voices feel involved, they are heard enough. And that starts with the right technology as well, so those people can be seen and heard properly. We are seeing different types of protocols being implemented around how any conversations in terms of chats that are happening within those meetings are also being observed at the same time. We are seeing different metrics come out that are those remote voices equal, if not more, in terms of the talk time. And we are also being kind of observing a number of factors around sort of involvement of people based on output, not based on presence, as a part of measuring people. So it's a mixture of how you operate in a hybrid meeting, to pick that example, which is very different compared to how we would have met in the past, where if somebody is not in sight, then they are not in the mind. All of that is changing, especially when you look at how best performing hybrid meetings are being conducted today.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. And let me move to another pillar of the framework, which is nurturing well-being. So obviously there have been a lot of talk in current years about mental health, why a lot of people are feeling overwhelmed with their work. Obviously we've been talking a lot about burnout. So why do you believe that health should become a key performance indicator?
Health is central to everything we do. So it will always remain one of the top priorities for smart organizations, irrespective of what sort of solutions we apply. And we've always got to keep improving it. I have taken a very basic yet different view in the book on that. I see a lot of offices with all sorts of amenities being offered to the employees. They may have yoga apps, they may have well-being initiatives, some even have sleep pods. But when you really look at real usage of some of those elements, you'd be surprised, because the cultural connotations start to kick in. Many people would avoid the usage of that at the back of how they would be seen. How would I be seen napping in the office? Especially if I'm booking a nap pod and everybody can see who's it booked by. Am I going to be seen as not performing when I'm coming in, for example, right? Or how many yoga sessions would be really helpful to me when I've got constant pressure coming from my team? from my organization to perform. I don't have enough hours in the day. So whilst these initiatives are very well intentioned, I think the real usage, which then drives the real benefits, can be questioned at the back of many other facets. And we are seeing that in terms of how those elements are being utilized. So when you consider any well-being initiative, you've got to consider these multiple facets along with them. Just providing a yoga app or sleep pods doesn't fulfill the core intent that you had to start with. So that's point number one. And if you were to look at any office, say, if you picked up the roof of an office at 11 a.m., you'd see cortisols rising, you'd see caffeine being pumped into people, right? That's all great because some people need that to be able to drive themselves. But constantly performing at that peak for 45 minutes or more does affect your decision-making capability because humans are humans at the end of the day. So we've also got to kind of start seeing that we need to build mechanisms for offering rest to those people to improve their decision-making as a whole. How is that being considered within the office design remains a question. Many designers, many occupiers are beginning to consider that. But again, in terms of the application, it all comes down to the behavioral and cultural aspect of things. So we highlight that, but we also take a very basic view within this thing that access to good air, access to natural light, access to the right lighting and acoustics, all of those elements are very primitive and they need to be considered in the application of how people work and how they are supported well. Let's not miss those elements out because you could go as far as you want, but if the basics aren't covered, again, those elements are not going to be fully effective. So I think all in all, what we are saying is absolutely focus on well-being, but definitely get the basics right and definitely get the culture and the behavior and the protocols right so people feel very comfortable in terms of making the most out of the initiatives that you're launching with the intent to achieve your overall goals.
Yeah, I absolutely agree about the basics. And just thinking of the role of the leader in all of this. So, is it all about educating people that yeah, they should be taking care of their well-being and that they wouldn't be looked down if they decide to take half an hour from their day so they can do something that really helps them with their well-being and then probably also their performance?
Yeah, I have come across many organizations over the last 20 years who have absolutely right intent. They definitely want their people supported. They want their well-being to improve. But when it comes down to, say, the application of it, I have observed a number of microcultures kicking in teams. So I have seen, say, one manager being really supportive of it. Within the same organization, you go to a different team. And the microculture is very different. And that's all about sort of performance, which then comes down to proximity bias, which would mean if I'm not at my desk, perhaps I'm not being seen as working. So within that element, I think looking at that, you've got to ensure that the management layer has that understanding, that training. And if they have concerns around performance, perhaps their team is under-resourced and they need support within that. Those elements must be considered for the layer of well-being to be applied consistently across the organization. And many of these elements are often missed out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think the role that leaders and managers play is enormous and sometimes is really not seen as it should be.
Yeah.
Great, but I will stop discussing the pillars now. Obviously, our listeners can grab the book and read more about the remaining pillars and obviously the ones we've just discussed briefly. But what I would like to ask you now, Sam, is what role purpose play in building the office of today? You've got a whole chapter in the book dedicated to purpose. So could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, purpose is basically an interesting one. I always say it's not a poster in the lobby. It's about actually what the organization is trying to achieve. And does everybody understand their role in doing that? Can they see the bigger picture? And what their contribution within that is. I think that's what basically defines a purpose, at least from the perspective of how Destination 2.0 operates. And an example of that is in terms of hybrid work, are you going into the office because you must be there physically, or are you going in there because you're driven by a purpose? A degree of collaboration, problem solving, innovation can only happen when you are face to face with your team. So that's a very simple way of looking at it. My belief is, from what I have seen and observed across multiple companies, a number of people are just going in because there's a huge amount of proximity bias in that organization. I must go in, I must be there because that's how I demonstrate I'm working. It is sort of being a little bit disconnected from the overall purpose of what I'm trying to achieve. And if you apply the purpose lens, then the conversation completely flips. I've met managers who say, what are we going to achieve by being together tomorrow that we can't achieve individually? And when she didn't get a clear answer, she released the next day for people to choose how they want to work. If they really want to focus and get tasks done from wherever they are, home or office, that was their choice. But all in all, the measurement of what that team delivered that week was based on outcome. And that was very purpose-driven. So I think we've got to be very clear on that aspect, because then it starts to flow down across the company.
Absolutely. And Sam, I've got just one final question to end this very interesting conversation on. So, could you share with us what happens in organizations when they design the workplace according to the Destination 2.0 framework? Can you share some examples of companies that did it well? What changed for them and for their employees? And what are the main benefits?
Absolutely. I think the biggest takeaway from Destination 2.0 thinking is that a workplace, an office, is a living and breathing organism. Its job is to support the business. The business is constantly changing and evolving, especially in the world we live today. We've got geopolitical tensions, we've got AI providing opportunities and threatening a lot of jobs right now. We've got strategies changing based on markets. We've got products shipping in days, if not weeks. All of those mean that businesses have to operate in a very dynamic manner, and the workplaces that support those businesses must move with the same level of dynamism to support those businesses. So all in all, what we say is that a workplace must constantly change and evolve because its core purpose is to support the business, its changing needs, and its evolving people as well. This means that offices shouldn't be seen as a start-stop projects. What really matters is how an office continues to listen beyond day 30, at day 90, at day 365. And those are the mechanisms we are providing in Destination 2.0 to enable those who sit behind the decision-making of offices, for them to understand that, for them to practically allow for certain things to happen that makes that workplace very dynamic. And Destination 2.0 will deliver that promise for them.
Great. Yeah, I think that's a great promise. But thank you very much, Sam, for your time today. It was great to chat about your book and some of the pillars of the Destination 2.0 framework. And I would encourage our listeners to obviously grab a copy and read all of your insights about the work of the office of the workplace today. But thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Taya. Thanks for your time, too.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.